Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started on and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. The Milk Carton Kids, Joey Ryan and Kenneth Pattingale, started making music together in 2011. Over the ensuing years, they've released a bunch of records, played a bunch of great shows. I've gotten to see them a couple of times here and there and been blown away to watch the magic that they are able to create with just their two voices and a couple of guitars. I am so glad to get them on this show. I was, full disclosure, a little concerned about trying to interview two people. It's always a little tricky, but I think it has worked well with them because they are complementary figures in the room, in the space, both musically and conversationally. And I think you will be able to differentiate between their two voices, their two personalities, also complementary, not polar opposites, but not terribly similar in their approach, in their sense of humor, in their take on things. We carried on our conversation after I had stopped recording for a little while, and I joked with them as we continued to talk that I wished I had recorded it because they just keep dropping knowledge. They've got lots of opinions, lots of deep thoughts, which sounds like I'm being silly, but it's so great. It's great stuff. I love hearing their take on stuff, and I think you are really going to enjoy hearing Joey and Kenneth from the Milk Carton Kids dig into their own personal creative journeys, their collective journey as the Milk Carton Kids, and I think you're really going to enjoy this Wheels Off. Please welcome Kenneth Pattingale and Joey Ryan, the Milk Carton Kids. Welcome to Wheels Off, Joey Ryan and Kenneth Pattingale, collectively known as the Milk Carton Kids. Hello, how are you?
Good.
Good.
I'm wondering where is Old Pulse?
The Old Pulse is probably in like Denmark, Holland, France, somewhere where the people who were escaping religious persecution came here from to make the New Pulse.
Right. Yeah, they took one look at Poughkeepsie and said, we're not living there.
Yeah, we got to go on the other side of the river.
Yeah.
It's a fun little college town, though. It's a lot of young kids wearing almost no clothes on freezing midnight sidewalks outside of nightclubs in my town.
Wow.
What is wrong with these people?
I know. I've seen that before in various cities across the nation. And you can only do it for like a couple years of your life, I think. And then something kicks in and you're like, that was, I don't know if they regret it or if they just outgrow it. And some people probably look back on that time and go, man, that was the best.
Did you guys go to college? Did either of you spend time in higher learning?
Kenneth went to college for a long time.
7 years.
That explains a lot.
Really? Yeah, I got very cold. 7 years of standing out nightclubs in hot pants. is. But in Southern California, that, you know, that's tenable.
We are both college graduates. Yes.
Oh, wow. For the edification of our listeners, where are you joining us from?
From LA. We have a recording studio in Los Angeles, California, where we both come from.
North Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. I guess it's North Hollywood.
Is this your own actual recording studio?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, that's great.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things you can waste money on in the music business. And we've tried them all. And we've settled on this one as being the most rewarding. Because at least you can hang here and keep your stuff. The one that's hardest when you pay all the money for the tour bus. And yeah, you're just burning oil and diesel fuel at rates that no man should. And you get to the end of it and there's no money left. And you're like, I just was aboard this tiny little coffin that gave me anxiety for all time. Like, shouldn't we change something?
What about when you own it and then it just sits in your driveway mocking you?
Is that?
I've never done that. I have friends. Okay. Shooter Jennings did that. I know Ben Queller did that. It's something you regret, I think.
Yeah. I can wrap my head around the van or the Sprinter van or whatever, but full like sleeper coach, whoever did that, they need a financial manager.
It's interesting. I've never had the impulse to buy a tour vehicle of any kind because that always felt like something that would hold you down more than free you up to do what you wanted. Maybe it's just because we've always been such a light operation as a duo where, you know, we feel like we can get anywhere in the world in a day. And if you've got your own vehicle sitting somewhere, then, you know, by the time you're going more than a couple hundred miles, that's like multiple days added on to the whole thing. Yeah, it always just felt like more of an encumbrance, if that's not a word, it probably should be.
No, it's a perfectly good word. You're doing great, Joey.
But the recording studio, we didn't even know was a dream we had until we got it like a year ago. And it came out of the process of making our album that we just made because we rented a studio for like 3 weeks, right?
Which was by far
the longest we had ever been in a recording studio. I think the most before that was like 10 days. And we just loved getting into the routine of waking up every day, going there in the morning. We had our lunch spot around the corner. We would work until some reasonable time in the evening and then go home. And like that routine was super productive and fun and rewarding. And we realized through that process, like we should probably, you know, this always.
That's what John Prine would do, specifically at the butcher shop a lot. But he'd finish a record after just, you know, renting out the studio for a few weeks and he'd finish it. And then the people that worked there would report for the next like 3 months. He'd show up at 9 a.m. with a coffee and newspaper, just sit in the lobby and do his morning routine and then kind of look at his watch around 11 and peep out and go do his thing. But he like so longed for the ritual and the routine that he was like, oh, this is a place I worked. I'll go. And I think also all of that said, I think he technically owned some of the butcher shop, so it was his place. But I feel like it wouldn't be unlike him to go do that, you know, at other random places that he set up for a little while.
It's funny. I feel like kids these days are more used to making records the way you described your most recent one, the way the old 97s make records, the way most people do now, where it's like 10 days and then maybe you'll do some overdubs here and there. But yeah, you're right. Back in the old days when there was money in the industry, I remember John Bryan and I rented out a studio in North Hollywood for like 4 months. Every day.
Yeah.
So stupid. But you guys you have that now.
Yeah.
It changed the whole, I mean, the 10 days seemed like a luxury when we did that. Before that, we did all three of our previous records in like 3 days. You know, it was like hardly a recording process. It was just like a capture it live and try and not mess it up.
The musical equivalent of like going to the mall to get prom photos.
Yeah.
That's what our recording career was prior to 2018. It was like, you pop in, let's take some photos to send around to the fam.
However you look that day, that's what's going in the photo album forever.
But it doesn't surprise me because I feel like the magic of what you guys do is built on that thing that you're able to do in one moment that other people chase in studios using Pro Tools and pitch shifting device, you know, software, whatever, for months and months. That's the magic. So for you guys to spend longer than 3 days in a studio, I don't know. Let's see.
Yeah, when we were doing those, it felt like, why would we ever need anything more than that?
Yeah.
But the spending 3 months, which, by the way, turned into a year because, of course, we didn't get it in 3 months.
Yeah.
Mostly what it was we were writing in the studio in addition to recording, which we had never done before. And we were like trying to also find what every record, I think we've tried to find something new to do with like our extremely limited palette of just the two of us and usually just our two guitars. And so we were trying to find out what that was going to be, you know, both from a songwriting perspective and then also from a studio perspective, instrumentation, production, you know, trying to figure out how to do anything, something new and different while still just being this minimalist thing that we are.
Do you think now that you have your own studio, will you wind up producing? Will you become shepherds of other people's music?
Yeah, that's a big part of Kenneth's life already.
Wow.
It had been. I hope that it would urge Joey to engage in that more in situations where commonly he wouldn't. I mean, not as like a, I'm not like ragging on you. I'm just saying like, oh, you'd be a good music producer. And I, knowing you, you also would never be bothered to go like drum up a project and rent out another studio and whatever. But here it could fall right into your lap.
Yeah, that's true.
Which you've already talked about that you're trying to get a session going next week.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we are. Yeah, so yes is the answer.
I love that. So typically this format is very one-on-one because I kind of try and dig into how you got started. So if you wouldn't mind, and I'm sure you guys are used to taking turns and sharing the spotlight, but would you explain to me how it all started for you in terms of, was there an epiphany moment for each of you when you remember that you were going to do music for your whole life, that like this is who you were? Kenneth, why don't you start?
Oh, man. Well, it's sort of always been that. And I talk, I often relate to people how lucky I feel in life, where I think the greatest privilege I've ever had is not having to put my head on the pillow and wonder existentially like what I want to do with my life. There has always been a real easy reason to like fall asleep because you know what you're working on the next day. And whether or not I had a choice in the matter, like I started playing the cello at age 4, you know, I don't think you were thinking much about your future then. But you know, that went from that to just consuming all the music of the day. This is like late 80s, early 90s. So I was, you know, I went through the Guns N' Roses and Metallica phases, and then all the crap that they put on commercial radio in the early 90s, whatever, blah, blah, blah. My entire life, the activities I was opting in for was music. And so it was sort of a given. And, you know, despite like various brushes with success throughout my 20s, it wasn't until Joey and I started a band at 29 where it actually like promised some longevity. But in my mind, those 30 years, there was never a point where I was like unsure about it. It just wasn't quite working yet. And then, you know, even I kind of have to check in with myself on a regular basis at 41 now, even to be like, is this working? Is this, do I have to do some other stuff? Like, I think there's a good enough plan where it's like, no, I can just stay in this lane for a while and it'll all work out. But, you know, life is not really that predictable or that steady. But so for me, I think the short answer is it's kind of always been that. There was never like a deliberate decision, or there was never a buy-in. It just was kind of a given, which I feel like more grateful for than a prisoner of, you know.
How do you explain the 7 years in college then?
Oh, well, I was going for free. And then there, at the time I was, I was doing competitive Scrabble playing and competitive bridge, like a contract bridge.
Are you kidding me? This is so great.
So there were times where like I would basically not like drop out of school, but I would whittle my schedule down to 4 credits so that I could devote all my time to thinking about playing like an antiquated, useless card game.
But your folks basically made you go to college. You wouldn't necessarily have gone to college if they didn't say, well, like, this is something you got to do. That's my understanding.
I don't know. I'm like a path. I'm a go with the flow kind of guy. Again, this, like, it was free.
His dad was affiliated with the university, so they got to go for free. So there was no pressure.
Yeah, except he put a lot of pressure.
Pressure to get out of there in 4 years and quit paying the tuition.
Right.
Yeah.
Had something. Yeah. The only reason I ever probably finished college was because it was important. It was like the only thing important to my dad, which is great.
Yeah.
That was like a result of many of his life, you know, choices and experiences. In his mind, it was like a binary thing. You finish an undergraduate education or you're like less set up for the world. And I think that was just one of his like crude ways of interacting with the human experience, which I'm grateful for in the end, because like, yes, there's definitely many moments where I could have been distracted and like jumped ship. But I saw it through and like, you know, it is what it is. I studied many things in college, none of them well. And then it finished. And then I have had a career that's had like, you know, nothing to do with any of that and everything to do with all of it. So, you know, here I am. Whereas Joey went to UC Berkeley, where, you know, like add up all of the expectations there. But he was like, he was like a druggy frat boy at UC Berkeley, not like a, you know, a empowered.
Do you appreciate this characterization, Joey?
California libtard.
No, I wholly reject that. Other than that, I did go there for college, and that my experience of getting into music is the opposite of what Kenneth's was, because it was completely deliberate and like intentional, and like I came to it late in life. I mean, my folks forced me to play an instrument of some kind ever since I was a little kid, you know, taking piano lessons at 5 years old. And then I played clarinet in the school orchestra and took a lesson once a week until I was 18 and they couldn't make me do anything anymore. But I never liked it. And I never wanted to, I never thought about making music every time I listened to music, there was tons of great music around the house. And I never thought about the people who were making it or if those were even real people at all. It just seemed like a totally foreign thing that existed in the world, like electricity, like how your lights turn on. And then at some point in college, I started getting broken up with. And then that was like, I had learned, my dad taught me to play songs on, my dad taught me like chords on a guitar when I was a teenager at some point. And so I had a guitar sitting around and I started writing songs on the edge of my bed to like, you know, make myself feel better. And, then I started playing in with some of my friends, just like jamming out, getting high and playing 2-3 chords all day long as a way of escaping from the pressures of academia. And then basically at the end of college, my friends who I had gotten a little band together with, which was never going to be anything serious, had a bit of an intervention with me, and they sat me down and they were like, "We think your songs are good, and obviously nobody here is taking this band very seriously, but like you should not go to graduate school and you should like actually try and be a songwriter." And so I like thought about it for a long time, and I talked to my parents about it. And shockingly, I remember like 3 months earlier when they had talked to me about what I was going to do after college, I was going to go to graduate school. I had studied psychology and I was interested in the brain and neuroscience, and I was going to apply to graduate PhD programs for that. And when I told them that, I thought they were going to be all happy and proud and excited. And instead they were like, really? Like, are you sure that's what you want to do? And I was like, yeah, I mean, all I ever did was be a student, and this is the natural continuation of that. And they were like, okay. And then a few months later, when I was like, actually, I think I'm going to move back in with you guys in LA and try and be a singer-songwriter, they were like over the moon about it. They were so excited. They were like, yeah, that seems good. That's what you should probably be doing. Even though I was terrible and, you know, was just starting, and the songs I was writing, I think, were bad. But anyway, it was a very deliberate like switch in life plan. And I never thought that it would last very long. I kind of made a promise to myself that I would try it for a year. And after a year, it wasn't going well. And I did quit and apply to go back to school again. And then right as this is getting to be a long story, but
I love it.
At various points of failure, there would be something that would happen that would be like, okay, a little bit longer, a little bit less. Some song would get used in a TV show or a commercial or something, or I would get like a couple $1,000s, and I'd be like, oh, okay, maybe I can keep going for a little while. So I didn't go to the school that I had. It was like graduate school was starting in like a month, and I just didn't go and kept doing music. And then eventually we met, and then all the times I felt like it was going well before that, once we met and we started to see what an actual career looked like, I was like, oh, I was delusional for 15 years about anything I was doing being really worthwhile or good or successful or having any sort of reach or anything.
It's funny, I to make sure there was nothing that I had missed, I went back and looked at your guys' Wikipedia, and there was the funniest line. I don't know if you ever look at your own Wikipedia, but don't look at Wikipedia. It's a nightmare. But it made me laugh so hard. It was on your biography. The Milk Carton Kids came together after both artists had largely unsuccessful solo careers.
That's probably a direct quote from one of us.
Like, dude, why are you shitting on me, Wikipedia? You're just sitting here. But that's how it works, right? Like, you fail and fail and fail, and then it clicks is what it feels like when you guys met. And I remember I was presenting at the AMA Awards in Nashville one year when you guys, I think, won the Best New Artist Award.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I'd seen you play, and I was blown away. And it's pretty undeniable. And obviously you guys have devoted your life to this collaboration, and so you're aware of the magic, but that's got to be a good feeling, right? When you flail and then didn't realize you were flailing until you stop.
Well, when you said epiphany before, like, the only epiphany I ever had really was when we first sang together. And, you know, various like duos and trios talk about that moment that they've had. And we definitely had that, you know, the first time we sang together.
Go ahead, Kenneth.
Sorry. I'd be very grateful for, because my experience with all of it is very confusing, and it could be to do with my own personality. I think this maybe would resound though with other people's experiences, is that, like, you know, your intention as a person, especially when it wraps up with the aspirations of like what musician you want to be and what songs you want to write and who you want to be on stage and what you want to give off, like, very rarely does that actually reflect the way that other people see you. And so to me, my career has been a series of like utter surprises where I'll work really hard on this one thing, and then at the end of it, it'll have been very valuable, but for a completely different reason that I entirely missed the point, and people latch on to another thing. And the experience of making music with Joey and having and like endeavoring a career with Joey, funny enough, has like provided a little more context and perspective to make that less confusing. But the rest of it, it's constantly this thing where you're going after something that you can't quite get or you can't quite circle. And then you sort of rest on your laurels, which maybe is your talent or maybe is like the most broad or like loudest thing that you speak. And oftentimes I find like engaging in music is having to come to terms with the fact that you're never going to get past that thing and that you need to not only embrace that thing, but that's the only thing that's ever going to connect with people. And so the rest of it, like I've learned for me, has been this kind of really frustrating process for decades where you try to go after a thing that never comes together only to finally sort of like circle the wagons enough to go, oh, that thing that I like kind of take for granted, that's the thing that makes sense.
You know what that reminds me of? Did you ever hear Conan O'Brien talk about all of his failures to become like the idols he was trying to become like?
No.
What did he say?
He's got a beautiful, I think maybe he was at a commencement speech that he gave or something, but you know, he said like, I think it's that all, you know, all he ever wanted to, for a while, all he ever wanted to be. No, it'll be that, like, you know, Jay Leno only ever wanted to be Johnny Carson. And because he couldn't, in trying to be Johnny Carson and failing, that's how he figured out who he was. And Conan only ever wanted to be Leno or whoever, you know, and because he couldn't, you know, his trying to be someone else who, and then striving for something that wasn't really him and failing is how he figured out who he really was. That reminds me of what you were just saying about, you know, you're pursuing these things we think about ourselves, the ideas we have about who we might be. And in the end, whatever it is that speaks most loudly and most truthfully, most naturally from you is the only thing that can really come through.
Which the confusing part of that, if that was like a clear option in front of me, I would not have chosen it 100% of the time. I'd always be like, eh, I want to do something else. That's weak. And it's this place that you like, you go away and then you come back and arrive at that. And it's like, you have to contend with that because it's kind of who you are, is the place that I find that I'm like constantly regressing to. And like I said,
yeah, it's your voice.
Meeting Joey and working with Joey has made that process like, I mean, at times endlessly frustrating, but in the end, more often than not, it's like kind of easier to go through that darkness with somebody else, like, you know, helping to whatever, bail water out of the boat.
So that's funny. That's something that I really wonder about and want to dig into in these conversations is that the interior obstacles, the stuff that we self-generate that keeps us from being who we should be, doing what we should do. I wonder what you guys have figured out as ways, strategies to get around those individually. And you guys are lucky because you obviously have collectively as an option as well.
Well, my big thing always, my hands down number one advice for everybody is just to let your freak flag fly. That's the only thing you got. And then at risk of that embarrassing you again, like being in a duo where somebody else has to like co-sign with you is a really great and natural way of like letting that happen. And then having somebody else pull you back and filter you back. But I think like, to be honest, I don't like stay up at night worried, but I constantly think about this. I confront this every day that we live in this world that has promised like a specific thing to everybody. I think like it's, I don't want to blame it on social media, but it definitely is like fully encapsulated in a world of social media where like, where these things are happen via social media, but there's this huge engine that pulls you away from where your like natural compass points and like at once both wants you to conform to a system, but like kind of under the false promise that it's going to be entirely on your own terms and it's going to be a world you get to build. But like, it means that I made four like full length albums before I ever did a concert, like for people.
Wow.
And those four albums, like I sent them to disc makers. I spent the $3,000 to have them print up 1,000. They're literally still sitting in my parents' garage in Eagle Rock. It's bad music. It was not worth the money. It was clearly all a part of the process, the whole thing. That like fact is embarrassing enough that like I envy the people that were 7 years before me because they couldn't call disc makers because disc makers wasn't a business. They maybe have a pile of like cassette tapes they dubbed and represents like a summer of work that was lost. None of that pales in comparison to the kid now that like, for me, that four albums worth, they're putting it on YouTube. It's public. Every decision they're making is in the context of them thinking about how to brand themselves, what to connect. And it's like, it fundamentally has to change this process that is like not meant. It's not meant to like be a 17-year-old trying to become Coldplay or whatever. And that's happening like en masse. And in some cases where there's like brilliantly talented people involved, you sort of see this new shade of the art form happen and it's kind of encouraging whatever. But the collateral damage, which is like our fellow people that just love music and are trying to do a thing, it's I think it comes at like a pretty significant cost. And like, I don't think that we're protecting our psyches on that level. I think that we've like, we've opened up this experiment to have like sort of truly grotesque layers that are going to like come at the cost of people's like precious souls is what I think.
Well, how uplifting.
No, I hate to say, but I agree. And it comes up a lot, especially with people your guys' age up to my age and older that lived in a world where social media wasn't so ubiquitous, that we see now the people that we end up mentoring or have open for us or whatever. We see how different their world is and how incredibly damaging the, you know, the technology is to their brains and psyches and hearts.
Yeah. And it's just too, there's like too much of a promise and a belief in it. I've got a great story for you, which is part of the thing I'm rejecting is like, you know, there's all these talented kids that make music. And then every time I hear about it, it's like, it seems like the topic of the songs is kind of a laundry list of like what you see on like stories on Instagram. People have like their various woke gripes with culture. They have like, you know, specifically of the last few years, I feel like it's very, it's like a common activity to be like hyper-focused on one's personal like mental health and state, and that like reporting on that in some kind of like emotional way seems like a valid artistic exercise for an entire subset of culture. And like, I get it. That's fashionable. I think that it's a fad. I think 10 years from now, people are going to be like, oh, that time of music when everybody was just literally like spilling their guts so hard. It's not like, it's not going to age well. And it reminds me of the one time that we lived on a tour bus with Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin for 3 weeks. And like,
I don't think you have to say what band he was in. I think people.
Wait, I thought he was in a band with Alison Krauss. You're freaking me out.
But so during that and like getting to know him and having all, and I'm like, I guess I'm like my parents this way. If I live on a tour bus with Robert Plant, I'm going to ask him all the embarrassing questions. And if he's not down with it, he's just going to have to leave. Like, there's nothing that's going to stop me from being like, tell me about this. And like the summation of all of that conversation left me with a few realizations, is that Led Zeppelin was a band for like way less time than we've even been a band. It was 50 years ago. He was 18. He said that entire time, all he was obsessed with Tolkien books. And he's just singing about like the misty mountaintops is like the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
That like music that changed the world, that like became a thing, was just an 18-year-old kid, like obsessed with sci-fi stuff didn't know what to write about, but like in the end, he grabbed something close to him, clearly like made it his own, infused all of this emotion into it, whatever, like, God, what would happen if Robert Plant was motivated to sing about his mental health and like, you know, whatever, when he was 18 years old, like, I'm not necessarily slagging people that choose to do that with their art presently. I just mean to say the other thing, like, in my opinion, opened up these universes that like we time traveled and went through, you know, like we had to connect the dots and somehow this stuff was cracked open. And like all of the music that's ever spoken to me is, and it's like straight up across the board from like the, you know, like the early Babylon, like American gospel music to like long extended African jams to old time music to fado music from Portugal, everything. Like the thing that always lights me up is that you hear it and instantly it's like a movie, like you're in another time and place where you can smell what's there. You can like feel the moisture in the air. You can do this. And I don't ever get that from the thing where people are really like following society real closely and like trying to be in the moment or trying to brand themselves, contextualize themselves. And it's such a funny thing because music is, can really be heady art. And then at the same time, I find because of like the fact that it's generally kind of shorter or smaller nuggets, and it's kind of like the places where it has been consumed for so long sort of makes the form of it become a certain thing. It's like, it's all of this wild imagination kind of packaged in. It's like a little snack, you know, music is, and songs are like a little snack that you can have. And that's a beautiful thing, I think, to be snacking on these things that like expand your imagination, your mind, and make you feel like you can time travel is like a way better snack than if you're sitting there just snacking on these things that like, you know, if I want to go hear about, you know, the mental health fight, like you don't need to turn on music. You can go read any op-ed, or you can go just open anybody you know's social media feed, because they're going to spend a big part of their day telling you, and you can get it right there. You know, like the higher process of songwriting isn't shedding too much light on the subject, I don't think. Whereas like, I do think it has the possibility to create these things that like you've never seen or heard. And like in my experience, that really makes me, I guess, feel good.
Yeah.
Is that all that it is? I think that might be all that it is. It just makes me feel good. But I think it's important to feel good in life. Like you have to make that choice.
Well, this comes up a lot. The idea that what we're doing in probably all the different media of art is that it's inherently valuable because we're trying to build bridges between human beings. And the feeling good that you describe is the feeling of maybe not being alone or being understood or heard or seen or having a, you know, some sympathetic connection to somebody you've never met, but you admire. So, yeah, I agree. And maybe.
Entertained.
Yeah.
Oh. Like this, the thing I find, like, did you ever find it really stupid that they like sing before sporting events? You know, like, never mind the value of being like very nationalistic. Never mind that. But like a bunch of people are about to go be physical. Let's get somebody to sing for 2 minutes beforehand. At the same time, if you watch Katie Lang sing like before the Olympics opening ceremony, that's like visiting God for 3 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and I guess, you know, thanks to whoever thought like, oh, before all these people beat each other up, let's watch a human spectacle, like a human magic trick. Like on a base level, human beings understand like that, being entertained and being entertained in such a profound and unbelievable way is life affirming and inspiring, and it's just a good way to spend 3 minutes sometimes.
maybe it's something akin to what cults or churches or whatever do, where they make everybody come together in some act of singing or appreciation of singing, and it bonds them so they can be a part of the cult of the Washington Commanders.
J.D. Lang Hallelujah cult any day.
Yeah.
My nephew, my very young nephew recently asked why they sing the national anthem before the sporting event. And, you know, whether it's, you know, nationalistic or whatever, the, I think my brother, his dad gave him what I thought was the right answer. I was impressed with this parenting skill, right, with this parenting answer, sort of off the cuff. But it was basically that, now this is a weird conversation about like sporting events and saying beforehand.
All right.
But it's specifically because these two teams are going to go try and kill each other for the next 45 minutes that we want to remember on some more fundamental level, we're actually all on the same team. And this is just entertainment. It is sport. It is an abstraction. And it's not war. And so we, you know, that if it's Katie Lang singing Hallelujah or whatever song it is, like that serves to sort of remind everybody that they're actually on the same team.
So it's an act of contextualizing.
I think so.
So Joe,
for a 9-year-old,
I never got to hear if you specifically have any secrets that you've figured out, strategies as ways around the sort of internally generated obstacle. The negative voices in your head, the success guilt comes up, imposter syndrome comes up a lot, these things, and just ways we've figured out to get past those.
The things that I think have worked for me have been so within the career, within music, like internally, figuring out that I'm a person that needs to be that needs to have a partner has been huge. I think there may be a fundamental thing of like there's two kind of people in this world, the people that want to work alone and people that want to work with a partner.
He partnered up with a guy who wants to work alone. It's a little bit of the problem, but you know,
yeah,
we're stuck with the people we love.
Yes.
And so looking back on my whole career, I've always wanted to work with a partner. There has always been someone in my musical life who I was like trying to collaborate pretty intensely with. As I look back over the years before I met Kenneth and finally found, you know, my person, basically. It's been the same for me outside of music, like with my wife. You know, we got together pretty young. I've been married for a long time. And so I just am a person who wants to go through life with a partner as well. And then so outside of music, the thing that helps me like contextualize the negativity or negative voices in music is like having a life outside of my career. I romanticize even the idea that like music should be a spontaneously generated reflection on a life rather than like the sole focus of the life, I guess. And maybe that's a cop out for somebody who just doesn't want to work that hard. But I love the idea that, you know, part of it is we're a little bit lucky in our genre. Like we're expected to release about 12 songs every 2 years and there's two of us. So I got to do six, right? Like, what? Okay. I got time and the desire and I get great fulfillment from like having a full life outside of, in addition to a music career, which I think really helps contextualize the music. It informs what the songs are going to be about and informs like the point of going on tour and standing on stages in front of these audiences around the world. Like, you know, I think both of us have had some revelations about what the sort of deeper purpose of all that is. but it helped to kind of get some time off these last couple of years and realize, you know, what, in what context we're actually doing all of this. So that, yeah, that helps a lot.
You've got a couple of kids?
Yeah.
That's sweet. Boy, that's, that becomes its own fucking thing, doesn't it?
You didn't mean it this way, but you said, that's sweet. Yeah.
Very, good luck with that. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mine are a little older. It's funny, just when they get older, it's bigger kids, bigger problems, but it's fine. It's a lot. Speaking of which, I'd like you, if you wouldn't mind, to try and distill some of this wisdom that you've been sharing. And if you wouldn't mind, imagine yourself meeting a 21-year-old version of yourself in today's world, and what advice you might give that younger you. Maybe Kenneth, if you don't mind starting.
Stop smoking so many cigarettes. That's good. Go to the dentist every 6 months, at least, at a minimum. No, it's a lot of the things that we have been talking about. It's a hard thing. I don't know if I would say much, you know, because let's be honest, is a 21-year-old going to listen to a 41-year-old, even if they look similar, or like, even if they think that's them from the future? Are they going to take any of that advice and not just do whatever they want or driven towards?
I would say a lot of what you just said a couple minutes ago to myself, which is that I would be scared. And I heard it put pretty succinctly, and God, and I can't remember by whom now, but it was a jazz pianist who said that when he was young, he and all of his jazz friends, all they did was talk about how much they sucked and how great they thought their idols were and how hard they were working to get better, to be worthy of what they thought they wanted to be worthy of. And now I think it's inescapable that now, because you're sort of expected to put everything online and out publicly immediately, you have to, from a very young age, adopt an attitude towards yourself of, look at how good I am. Look at what I just made. Everybody, look at what I just made. Smash that like button and subscribe. Like, I am worthy of all of your attention. And he was, and for him, it was like antithetical to the point of trying to get better, basically, which is what you're supposed to be doing. Like, so I feel very grateful that we came up right before all that stuff was happening. And I think that if I were talking to myself or anyone who was right at the beginning, I would encourage them as strongly as I could to just tap into the idea, which I still cherish so much for myself, tap into the feeling of finishing a song that you're really proud of for its own sake, and really truly try to not care if anybody ever hears that song, and resist putting it out or on the internet or whatever, and just bask in that feeling of achievement of having done something artistically that you feel proud of in that moment, and move on to the next one. And try and keep it to yourself as long as you can.
I love it.
I'll tell you, the other funny side of it for me is I do produce a lot of artists, and it's basically like a one trick job is what I've learned. And it's an important job, and arriving at this moment for yourself is probably the trickiest part, and is maybe why there is a job as a producer. But of all the people that I've worked with, like, I only ever choose people that I'm in awe of musically. You know, there's something that they do that inspires me. I'm not a vocal coach. I don't understand music super well. I don't think that I'm somebody that can come in and, like, you know, put together the final pieces of something that somebody's lacking. Like, the only time I ever work with somebody is like, oh, there's obviously something so wonderful that moves me, and like, I can see that you're either going to get in the way of it or you're going to move past the point or whatever it is. I just want to take a little picture of that and maybe show it back to you and say, I think this is worthwhile. And in all of these cases, literally, I'm trying to think of a scenario where it's not the case, and I can't, is that invariably people from just starting their career to completely successful, they're just unsure of themselves, and they're unsure of what they're doing is good enough. They want to do it better, and that the entire job is to find something with value and then tell somebody like, this is good enough. What you just did is good enough. Let's not fuck with it anymore. Because again, it taps into, I guess, a lot of what we're talking about as we move further and further into the world that we're in. I feel like this world just continues to give you more options to fuck with things in a pointless way. It's like the reason all of the machines exist and all the companies exist is somebody's like, fuck with some shit on our terms because they'll get some money for whatever it is, but it's just fucking with shit. It's like what Joey said, if you wrote a song and you didn't express what you need to entirely, okay, you need to keep working on it. But once you arrive to a point, there has to be a point where you can like accept what you're doing and not want more out of it. And that's the hardest thing for artists to find, I think. And again, it's more my work as a producer than an artist really like brings that into focus, because it's people that are truly doing magic tricks in front of my face. And then they come in, they go, ah, that wasn't it. And it's like, the entire job is like, no, that, and we don't have to edit it. And we don't have to like take out the blemishes. Like that was important and good. And like, again, with the music thing, is like, it's not like you're trying to assemble a 2-hour movie with a cohesive thing and everything. It's like, it's just 3 minutes. When somebody spends months working on a 3-minute song, like the only thing I want to do is remind them like Patsy Cline cut crazy in a like 2.5-hour session before lunch in Nashville. Like you shouldn't need any more time than that. And if you're not getting there, you need to figure out what else you're going to work on to arrive at a point where you can like do something you can accept as valuable in a little 2-hour chunk where like nobody's hungry by the end of it. Nobody's like, you know, driven to fisticuffs or whatever. Like it should be a pretty simple thing that's pretty happy, that's enjoyable, that maybe like brings you closer to other human beings, maybe brings you closer to your truth. Like, you know, it's that kind of stuff. And to me, that's the one for a 21-year-old, you know, you don't know if they're upset with themselves because they either can't accept themselves or if they need to spend a little more time getting better. You know, those are two very different things. But I think in both cases, the only thing I'd try to encourage is like, be kind to yourself. And again, I don't think any 21-year-old that you tell that to is going to hear it, because their body doesn't ache. You know, yeah. It's like real easy when you're 41 and you wake up and every day and your body aches, it's like a little easier to be kind to yourself because you need it. But at 21, you know, there's all these hormones pumping, nothing hurts.
You're invincible.
Yeah.
Man, you guys, I feel like this was super useful, and I hope that there are a bunch of 21-year-olds that find this and get so much really great wisdom and advice and just usable shit out of what you guys have said. So Joey and Kenneth, I really appreciate you giving me the time and showing up for Wheels Off. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, right. Anytime.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris. Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.